The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That is GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. The most recent edition of Time from which I will read is dated April 10/April 17, 2023. Up in the right-hand corner, just big enough for a person's thumb, it says our 100th year. The cover is bordered in red with a narrow inner border. Time, in large capital block letters, is in a burgundy to black coloration, superimposed upon a, I'd say, a dark burgundy to russet colored background featuring the portrait of El Mundo de Bad Bunny, a young man with wavy dark hair, facial hair, golden facial earrings, golden jewelry around his neck and on his right hand and his right wrist, wearing black. It looks like a black tunic with an open neck and a large gardenia type, I'm thinking fabric flower, on the left-hand side of that. There will be a few articles from that, and then I have gone into the archives for the February 13/February 2023 edition. Same type of border, except Time is in pale gray superimposed on white with a collage or montage of people and places and things having to do with our democracy, apparently. There's a facade photograph of the Capitol building, several people's faces, flags, flowers, signs. It is a bit of an abstract composition. So I will be reading from that edition after the first few articles, and I will tell you when I switch. From the View, Education, The Point of College, by Jenny Anderson. Soon after the 2008-09 financial crash tanked the economy, Americans' unflagging faith in higher education started to falter. By 2011, more than half of college graduates were un- or underemployed. The economy rebounded and the conversation faded, only to be revived again by the epic fallout from the pandemic. This time, the college degree's comeuppance has been more profound. In 2019, Americans ranked preparing for college 10th on a survey conducted by Populus, a nonpartisan think tank which asks respondents every year to rank answers to the question, what is the purpose of education? In 2022, respondents ranked it 47th out of 57 items. The value proposition of college may not be what it once was, says Todd Rose, co-founder of Populus. He is clear that the data say not that it is not valuable, but rather that a prioritization of careers and the pursuit of meaningful work has surpassed it. People want it to be on the menu, but not to be the menu. In 2009, 70% of recent high school graduates enrolled in college. In 2021, the figure was 61.8%, about where it was in 1994. What happened? In the Populus study, the number one purpose for the fourth year in a row was that students develop practical, tangible skills. such as managing one's finances and preparing meals. Other highly ranked measures included thinking critically to solve problems and make decisions, and demonstrating character. Being prepared for a career ranked 6th, up from 27th before the pandemic. College is a necessary and valuable pathway for many careers. It can help learners expand their worlds and try out different identities. It can be transformative for individuals and families, especially first-generation college students. And it should be a foregone conclusion that primary and secondary education prepares all students for going to college. But just as not everyone is cut out to be a pilot or a plumber, not everyone needs to spend 2 to 4 years studying. Students' interests vary widely, and their flourishing will require more recognition by all of us that human variation is a feature and not a bug. We got to 70% by way of social engineering, not choice. Campaigns extolling higher education as a way to work smart rather than hard, with images of a dirty plumber next to a shiny college graduate, did not factor in the price of tuition. There are also structural reasons underpinning our nation's newfound hunger for skills. An unusually tight labor market means employers are less inclined to require degrees. What started with tech has now spread to even the public sector, with Pennsylvania being the latest state to drop college degree requirement for most state jobs. The Harvard Business Review and the Burning Glass Institute estimated last year 1.4 million jobs would be available to workers without college degrees in the next 5 years. Over two-thirds of Americans do not have a bachelor's degree, and many careers do not require it. The alternatives now available for learning and training are far richer than they used to be. Before the pandemic, Coursera added about 2 million new learners a quarter. Since the pandemic, that has increased to 5 million per quarter, with 113 million registered learners. That platform offers courses in everything from computer science to the secrets to happiness, skills, and academic training for businesses to offer employees and degrees. The U.S.'s mistake was not in lionizing higher education, but in stigmatizing the alternatives. In Germany and Switzerland, one-half to nearly two-thirds of students pursue vocational education. Classroom learning does not end, but it changes. If we want to focus on helping young people prepare for meaningful work, we do not need to declare the college degree dead. Colleges are excellent at developing many of the power skills, formerly known as soft skills, that employers want to hire for. Analytical thinking, active learning, complex problem solving. Graduates advance science and build knowledge. Data continue to show college graduates earn more, are employed at higher rates, and tend to have a stronger sense of identity than those with only a high school diploma. But the reality is that there are many ways to build identity and purpose, and many pathways to good earnings, especially when the fastest growing jobs require specialized expertise, that is, vaccine specialist, customer marketing manager. What is an education for? If it is to prepare for meaningful work and meaningful lives, an arms race toward college, affordable for only the elite, is not a sustainable way forward. We should offer young people a broader set of opportunities and pathways to realize their future selves, including, but not extolling, the college degree. The author, Jenny Anderson, is a journalist working on a book on the science of motivating teens. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Erdogan faces a quake and a united opposition. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was mayor of Istanbul when a devastating earthquake hit Izmit in 1999, killing more than 17,000 people and devastating the country's economy. The government's shambolic response to the natural disaster allowed Erdogan to burnish his credentials as a capable and compassionate leader, setting the stage for his election as premier in 2003. Erdogan has maintained an iron rule ever since, outliving economic downturns, refugee crises, corruption scandals, protest movements, and even a coup attempt. But with the May 14 presidential and parliamentary elections coming up, two seismic shifts threaten Erdogan's grip on power. The most obvious challenge to Erdogan's re-election is his botched response to the earthquakes that rocked Turkey and Syria in February, which claimed over 45,000 lives and internally displaced some 2 million people. The government's emergency rescue efforts were plagued by incompetence, and many Turkish citizens blame Erdogan's consolidation of power and populist policies for allowing shoddy construction to grow unchecked. The second and perhaps more significant challenge to Erdogan's rule is a main opposition bloc that has united behind a joint presidential candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. I'm going to spell both those names, K-E-M-A-L space K-I-L-I-C-D-A-R-O-G-L-U, leader of the People's Republican Party, CHP. Kılıçdaroğlu, all right, I'm sticking with that, has surprisingly managed to consolidate much of Turkey's notoriously fractious opposition under the umbrella of the Nation Alliance, which comprises social democrat, center-right, right-wing, and Islamist parties, while also expanding support for the bloc. To have a shot at beating Erdogan, Kılıçdaroğlu needs to win over the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, HDP, and its left-wing Labor and Freedom Alliance, the election's kingmakers, without alienating his biggest coalition party, the Turkish Nationalist and Conservative Good Party, IP. This is a tricky balancing act, but one he is proving capable of pulling off. Recent polls show Kılıçdaroğlu leading the president, although neither candidate is likely to attain a first-round win. As things stand, the HDP is also likely to hand the anti-Erdogan Nation Alliance a slim majority in parliament. Critically, an opposition victory in the parliamentary elections would boost Kılıçdaroğlu's chances in the second round of the presidential contest. Of course, it is too early to say if Kılıçdaroğlu can hold the coalition together and sustain his momentum. And having already hollowed out most independent checks on his power, Erdogan will use any means at his disposal to tilt the scales in his favor. Even if fear tactics and repression help him secure another term, Erdogan's political reign has never been on shakier footing. Health Matters by Alice Park, senior health correspondent. Climate experts have long warned about the many ways a warming planet can negatively affect human health. Now that global temperatures are predicted to increase by 1.5 degrees centigrade by the 2030s, that risk is becoming increasingly real. One long-held prediction that appears to be coming true, according to the results of a study recently published in Nature Scientific Reports, is how climate change might expand concentrations of bacteria that thrive and spread through warm sea waters and cause an infection with a particularly high fatality rate. Vibrio vulnificus flourishes in salty or brackish waters above 68 degrees Fahrenheit. Infections are currently rare in the U.S., but that is likely to change. Using 30 years of data on infections from the bacterium reported to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, scientists at the University of East Anglia in the U.K. found that Vibrio vulnificus is expanding from its historic Gulf Coast range, with more northern states reporting infections as waters become warmer. We are seeing the core distribution of infections extending to areas that traditionally have very few and very rare cases, says Elizabeth Archer, a PhD researcher in the School of Environmental Sciences at the University of East Anglia and lead author of the study. But these areas are now coming into the main distribution of infections. Based on the latest data on how much the world's water and air temperatures will rise, the scientists predict that by 2081, Vibrio vulnificus infections could reach every state along the U.S. East Coast. Currently, only about 80 cases are reported in the U.S. each year. By 2081, that could jump to 200 cases, the authors say. Such a proliferation could have serious health consequences. Vibrio vulnificus kills approximately 20% of the healthy people it infects and 50% of those with weakened immune systems. There's no strong evidence that antibiotics can control the infection, but doctors may prescribe them in some cases. People can get infected either by eating raw shellfish like oysters or by exposing small cuts or wounds to waters where the bacteria live, which can lead to serious skin infections. Warming sea temperatures are not the only reasons behind the rise of Vibrio vulnificus. Hotter air also draws more people to the coasts and bays, bringing them into closer contact with the bacteria. The bacteria are part of the natural marine environment, so I do not think we can eradicate it from the environment, says Archer. It is more about mitigating infections by increasing awareness and improving education about the risk. To alert people to the growing threat, monitoring systems are needed to track when concentrations of bacteria start to rise, similar to currently available pollen and pollution alerts. Vibrio vulnificus is so sensitive to temperature changes that concentrations could bloom after even a day of warmer water. So consistent monitoring and alerts are critical, says Ian Lake, professor of environmental epidemiology at University of East Anglia and senior author of the paper. Lake says the expansion of Vibrio vulnificus is concerning for public health, since the bacteria are now invading waters closer to heavily populated areas, such as New York and Philadelphia. Everyone can get a Vibrio vulnificus infection, he says, but the more interaction there is between warmer waters and people, the more the bacteria can move into populations such as the elderly and those with other health conditions who are more vulnerable to infections. There's a small inset photo here of a beach front. On the left, the water. In the background, the light blue sky dotted with white clouds, fluffy, fluffy white clouds. On the right-hand side, sand, a sandy beach. On the far right side, towering buildings, perhaps apartments, perhaps other residences or hotels. The site of this photo is not given. The caption reads only, "Warming U.S. waters are harboring more bacteria." And near the shore, I can't tell you how many feet from sand to surf, but near the shore is a crowd, a big crowd of people. The Space Brief by Jeffrey Kluger, editor at large. The comet known as Oumuamua, Hawaiian for visitor from afar, sailed through our solar system in 2017 and right away made news. Its small size, barely a quarter mile long, and strange elongated shape made it an odd cosmic spectacle. What is more, its trajectory indicated that it came from outside our solar system, making it the first known interstellar object to visit our corner of space. And there was one other thing about Oumuamua that caught astronomers' eyes. It sped up when it was leaving the solar system, far more than ordinary comets do when they're flung away by the sun's gravity. That led to some wild speculation that Oumuamua might be an alien vehicle buzzing our solar system. Now a new paper in Nature explains the acceleration, and alas, no aliens are involved. Instead, the researchers concluded water ice inside the comet was cold enough when it was in deep space that it entered what is known as an amorphous state, with Swiss cheese-like pockets in it. Cosmic rays caused some of the H2O in the water ice to break down, and gaseous hydrogen filled the pockets. When the comet entered our solar system, the sun warmed the comet enough for the ice to resume its normal crystalline state, squeezing the pockets shut and causing the hydrogen to exit the comet in powerful plumes that then propelled Oumuamua enough to explain its previously mysterious acceleration. That answer is not as exciting as the extraterrestrial one, but it has the benefit of being good, solid science. Meanwhile, the hunt for ET goes on. Ollie Wong and Stephen Ewan face off in a beef for the ages. This is by Judith Berman. Ali Wong, A-L-I space W-O-N-G, and Stephen Ewan, S-T-E-V-E-N space Y-E-U-N, face off in beef, and that's in all capital letters, for the ages. Beef arrived on Netflix April 6th. Implicit, this is a review, implicit in every viral road rage video is the same question. What is wrong with these people? Beef, a wild black comedy from first-time creator Lee Sung-jin, delves deep into the sources and fallout of two L.A. motorists' fury. Danny Cho, Stephen Ewan, is a struggling contractor racked with guilt over his immigrant parents' involuntary return to Korea. Amy Lau, Ali Wong, longs to sell her thriving houseplant business and stay home with her husband George, Joseph Lee, and daughter June, Remy Holt. Their parking lot showdown leads to a ridiculous chase through suburbia, and then months of ever-escalating attempts to ruin each other's lives. At first, this premise seems better suited to a feature than a 10-episode Netflix series, but Lee is doing more than just a live-action Looney Tunes bit. The pranks yield insights into both characters' unhappiness. Desperate to maintain the serene front that is vital to her brand, Amy quietly seethes over a meddling mother-in-law, Patty Yasutake, the manipulations of a billionaire, Maria Bello, who might acquire the business, and George's insistence on following in his artist father's footsteps, despite his lack of talent. Danny is in debt to a scary cousin, played by the artist David Cho, and feels responsible for his slacker younger brother, Paul, Young Mazzino. The show fleshes out not just its leads, but also their families, who face stressors of their own. The irony is that for all their bad behavior, Danny, Amy, and most of the people around them are far from evil. But by failing to extend empathy, everyone contributes to a rapidly accelerating crisis. One of several upcoming TV projects from A24, the studio behind Everything Everywhere All at Once, Beef, is the kind of smart, sophisticated, polished comedy that Netflix has mostly stopped making. It is also the rare show that honors the differences in class, ethnicity, and personality that make each of its mostly Asian American characters unique, rather than flattening them into some exercise in positive representation. It is a remarkably confident debut from Dave Vett Lee, and one that ups its ante until the bitter, big-hearted end. Another review from Time Off Movies. This is by Stephanie Zakarik. Making anything of value, a work of art, a poem, a solid piece of furniture, demands a deep descent into the self to the point that it's easy to neglect the needs of others in your orbit. Stay in the zone too long and there's a danger of forgetting how to have a simple conversation or make a phone call, of going a little feral. Going into that inner wilderness is great, as long as we can follow the trail of breadcrumbs back to the world of human connection. That's just one of the ideas at play in Kelly Reichardt's quietly extraordinary Showing Up, a movie so fine-grained you're almost not prepared for the subtle power of its ending. The story is brought to land, almost literally, with the beating of wings. Michelle Williams is Lizzie, a sculptor, living in Portland, Oregon, and getting ready to mount a small, but for her, important show. Before we even meet her, we see soft watercolor sketches of her ceramic works in progress, carefully molded figures of women of all ages who seem to be dancing or weeping or possibly both. These works are rounding the bend toward completion, and we watch as Lizzie scrutinizes them, tracing their now hardened contours as if trying to reclaim with her fingers one last memory of the formerly soft clay. This, in movie form, is one idea of what it is like to make and think about art. Its meaning can seem to pass through our skin, a mysterious vibration. But, like all artists, Lizzie is also, whether she wants to be or not, a person living in the world. She has a small studio and living space that she rents from her closest friend, Joe, the remarkable Hong Chao, also an artist with a personality as breezy as Lizzie's is thorny, though she too is preparing a local show, too, in fact. She's happy to spend any spare time she's got installing a tire swing in the backyard of her small apartment building, rather than addressing the more immediate problem presented by Lizzie's broken hot water heater. Lizzie watches, her brow a tiny thundercloud, as Joe twirls in her newly installed swing, living the idea of what we want an artist's life to be. Everything about Lizzie is coiled tight. What about her hot water? What about her needs? She's preparing a show, too. She stands there, sullen, but also perplexed, her arms dangling in her shapeless cotton clothes like a Roz Chast cartoon come to life. This is the magic of Williams' performance, playing a woman whose art demands deep inner travel, but whose movement through the everyday world could use some improvement. Retreating into the world of her girls, as others refer to her sculptures, is less bewildering to Lizzie than the real life she is stuck with. She has a dull day job in a small arts college run by her mother, Jean, Marianne Plunkett, and her father Bill, Judd Hirsch. Once a prolific ceramicist, has retreated into a world of flaky hippiedom. She's also consumed with worry about her brother Sean, played superbly by John Magaro. He may be the biggest genius of the whole gang, but he's also the most fragile, a semi-lost soul whose clumsy manners belong to another world. Lizzie has more moderate problems, too. It's her cat, Ricky, a small orange jerk, who sets the plot in motion with a flick of his paw. Lizzie's bedeviled by all of it, and Williams, a formidable actor, channels her annoyance like a subsonic hum. This is the fourth movie she and Reichardt have made together. They're simpatico souls. Reichardt, who also co-wrote the script with her frequent collaborator Jonathan Raymond, could not have made a movie as weird and great and intimate as this one with just anybody. The on-the-surface modesty of showing up is a kind of sorcery. It is in the days afterward, when you've left its spell and gone back to the world, that its essence is more likely to take shape. A shape you could almost trace with your thumb, as if it were made of clay and not images, air, and feeling. And now switching to the Time edition from February 13/February 20, 2023. The View Inbox, the DC Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. When the Catholic Diocese of Des Moines reopened its doors to its 17 schools and 4 hospitals in January, there were some changes that telegraphed just what the leaders thought about gender politics. The wokes had lost. A 6-page policy forbids students, parents, or congregants to use the gender identity or pronouns of their choice to provide for hormone therapy to prevent puberty or to present in alignment with their own sense of gender identity, or to wear clothing deemed inconsistent with traditional ideas of gendered garb. Students must play on the sports team corresponding to their gender assigned at birth, use the locker rooms to match, and visitors must follow the same policy. The new rules cover all Catholic programs operating in that 12,000 square mile southwest quadrant of Iowa. Home to 130,000 Catholics and the latest proving ground for the culture wars. The gambit might lack as wide an appeal as conservative leaders believe. In fact, it may backfire. In a nationwide survey from December, just 1 in 5 parents told pollsters from the Democratic firm Hart Research Associates that they see teachers promoting woke ideas. 3/4 of parents said teachers should engage in tough conversations about history and current events. And 2/3 of parents say this culture wars are a distraction from the school's core mission of education. It is a keep the base angry strategy. It is a keep things chaotic, keep things divisive political strategy. American Federation of Teachers Chief Randy Weingarten says her union paid for the poll. The analysis is smart, yet small comfort if you're a student, parent, or health care provider in Iowa. Still, the numbers suggest the culture war's potency is no longer to be taken as a winning matter of faith. From the heading Nation, our enduring discontents, how to understand America. This is a long article by Isabel Wilkerson, who is a Pulitzer Prize winner and the author of Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents, and that is C-A-S-T-E, from which this essay is adapted. It was out in paperback February 14, copyright 2020-2023, by Isabel Wilkerson. How did our country arrive at this moment of rupture and fury? How is it that mass shootings, even of children in their classrooms, and police killings of unarmed citizens of color like Tyree Nichols have become a feature of our days? How is it that politicians are banning books in a country whose founding First Amendment protects the right to free speech? How is it that the U.S., despite its wealth and technology, leads the world with more than 1 million deaths from COVID-19, more than any other nation on earth? How is it that insurrectionists could storm the citadel of American democracy in a crusade to overturn a presidential election? How is it that we actually saw a Confederate flag inside the U.S. Capitol, that a rioter in our era could deliver the Confederate flag farther than Robert E. Lee himself? In the 2 years since the global concept of caste, C-A-S-T-E, entered the national conversation with the initial release of Caste, the Origins of Our Discontents, recent events have lamentably only affirmed its observations that the will to maintain the caste system would drive some people to trample democracy itself, as we saw January 6, that powerful forces would seek to reverse the rights of the marginalized and less powerful, as we have seen in recent Supreme Court rulings, that these turns of events are a natural consequence of our unreconciled history, because all told, our country is not terribly unlike a patient with a pre-existing condition like heart disease. And if ever a heart patient without treatment or intervention has a heart attack, it should come as no surprise to anyone. When we open our eyes to it, the ancient lens of caste helps explain most every regression we are now undergoing. It accounts for oppression of all kinds across time and space, allows us to understand the human impulse toward tribalism and domination, and the ways in which the restrictions on those least valued in a hierarchy radiate outward to everyone and endanger our planet. Caste is essentially an artificial, arbitrary, graded ranking of human value, the underlying infrastructure of a society's divisions. Any number of random metrics could be used to divide and rank people in a caste system: ethnicity, lineage, religion, language. In our case, the early colonists took otherwise neutral physical characteristics that comprise what we now see as race, a relatively new concept in the span of human history, and used this to determine who would be enslaved or free, who would have rights or none at all, and assigned groups to an inherited role in a hierarchy that has persisted to this day. For as long as there's been a United States of America, people of European descent, people who looked like the early colonists, have been the majority and the dominating caste. What happens if the demographic configuration that Americans have grown accustomed to transposes to a distribution the country's never known? What happens at merely the thought of a reconfiguration, the looming prospect of 2042 or 2045, the years the census has alternately projected as the point of a demographic sea change? These were questions that originally propelled me as I trained a light on the stress cracks in this old house, our country, and its foundation. Then in 2021, a year after Caste was first published, the Census Bureau made a startling announcement in alignment with an underlying premise I foreshadowed in the book. For the first time in American history, the white population showed a numerical decline, the only racial or ethnic group to do so, falling by 8.6%, from 223.6 million in 2010 to 204.3 million in 2020, as the white birth rate lagged that of the black and Latino population, and as white deaths exceeded white births. While still in the majority, the share of the dominant caste to identify as white alone in the population of the U.S. had fallen from 63.7% in 2010 to 57.8% in 2020, the lowest on record, the Associated Press reported. This was seen by some Americans as an alarming development. A Pew Research Center study found that while the majority of respondents said they were neutral about an impending demographic shift, nearly 4 in 10 conservatives said a declining white population was bad or very bad for the country, as did 1 in 4 white respondents overall. It was in this atmosphere that the language of replacement theory, the belief in a left-wing campaign to subsume the white majority with immigrants and people of color, leading to white extinction, entered the mainstream, and that powerful forces took dramatic steps to fortify the numbers and primacy of the historic majority. Thus, with the caste system under threat, we were witnessing desperate efforts to impose the will of a diminishing but dominant subset of Americans onto the rest of the country. What could account for the convergence of fixations on controlling the population in the most intimate of spaces, in the push to ban abortion and deny autonomy in how and when to build one's family, in the push to restrict immigration from south of the border, in the push to restrict LGBTQ rights, which amounts to denying unions seen as less likely to produce children and forbidding people to be who they are and love whom they wish. From a caste perspective, recent developments boil down to this. While many opponents of abortion rights may surely be acting out of sincere religious convictions in matters of childbirth, rulings that ban abortion and restrict voting rights serve to enshrine the objectives of a conservative minority and to shore up the caste system for generations to come. A rise in birth rates and thus a rise in the population in the red states, those that most readily enacted abortion bans, could grant those states and conservative policies in general a greater weight in Congress and in national affairs, even as the majority of Americans, polls show, do not agree with these rightward extremes, even in states most affected by them. One state, Georgia, has already elevated embryos to virtual citizens by permitting people to claim them as dependents on their tax returns after 6 weeks of gestation, and by allowing the state to include fetuses in its population counts, potentially bolstering the state's numbers. Bans on abortion would seem to open the door to a disproportionate number of black and brown births, but the caste system throughout our history has shown it can mutate to sustain itself when under threat. In addition to immigration restrictions to control the Latino population overall, some Latinos, the white adjacent middle caste subgroups already being courted by conservative elites, could conceivably be folded into the white population to shore up dominant caste power, as with Italians and Irish in previous generations. Failing all else, the caste system can resort to violence against those in the middle and subordinated castes, as we've seen in the shootings of Asian women in Atlanta, of black shoppers in Buffalo, New York, Latinos in El Paso, Texas, with the Buffalo shooter declaring his motive was to prevent eliminating the white race. The system has already created structural limits on the growth of the subordinated caste. Mass incarceration for nonviolent crimes often on charges for which the dominant caste receives lesser sentences, keeps a disproportionate share of black men from the reproductive pool for long periods of time. The school-to-prison pipeline, harsher punishment of black school children, and high rates of police brutality continue to threaten the subordinate caste population. But perhaps most directly, widespread bias documented in study after study of the health care system prevents many pregnant women in the subordinated caste from getting the treatment they need, their humanity and symptoms often dismissed, imperiling the lives of black mothers and children, as in the near tragedy faced by Serena Williams. One of the most decorated women in tennis history, who had access to the best medical care available, nearly died after giving birth to her daughter in 2017. She suffered paralysis in her legs and back and struggled to breathe. Yet hospital staff at first paid little heed when she alerted them to symptoms she recognized as a recurrence of blood clots that had nearly killed her years before. She asked for a heparin drip to thin the blood and wondered why they'd not started one already, given her medical history. She requested a CAT scan to locate any clots. But a nurse told her, "All this medicine's making you talk crazy," and she needed to rest. "No, I'm telling you what I need," Williams told the nurse. "I need the scan immediately, and I need it to be done with dye." Williams persisted and finally got a CAT scan. "Lo and behold," Williams recounted in Elle magazine, "I had a blood clot in my lungs, and they needed to insert a filter into my veins to break up the clot before it reached my heart." Mothers and babies from the subordinated caste are more likely to die from complications of childbirth than any other group in America. The black maternal death rate is 3 times that of white women overall, and not surprisingly, from a caste perspective, the death rate's 5 times higher for college-educated black mothers than for college-educated white mothers. The disparities are so wide, a college-educated mother from the subordinated caste is more likely to die from childbirth than a dominant caste mother who did not finish high school. The inequities continue to the newborns themselves. The black infant mortality rate, IMR, is twice that of white babies, and black women with doctorates and professional degrees have a higher IMR than white women who never finished high school, according to the authors of a 2018 Duke University report. Not only does the black-white disparity for infant mortality exist at all educational levels, it's greatest for those with a master's degree or higher. Further, the IMR is highest for black women with a doctoral or professional degree. These counterintuitive outcomes reflect both the long-standing resentments, unconscious biases, and pressures faced by those who defy their unexpected place at the bottom of the caste system, and the toll on the bodies of those who may experience weathering, the dangerous shortening of the telomeres at the ends of the cells, as they, by their ambitions and achievements, find themselves in continuous contention with the boundaries of caste. All of these factors, undergirded by caste, keep black childbirth structurally under assault. Further, if these abortion bans were solely about the sanctity of life, then visibly pregnant women in the subordinated caste would not be attacked or killed by the authorities at a time of declared urgency over the fate of the unborn. Leading up to the reversal of Roe v. Wade, as in the case of a pregnant woman shackled in New York City while in active labor, and of a pregnant woman thrown face down with an officer kneeling on her back in Kansas City, Missouri. The hazards of being forced to carry pregnancies to term could lead to more tragic outcomes and deaths for black women and babies, with a 2021 study by sociologist Amanda Jean Stevenson finding that the death rate for black mothers will rise by as much as a third under these abortion bans. Thus, given the risks of the subordinated caste, forced reproduction suggests an underlying will to curate the American population, to forestall the day the dominant caste might be in the minority, and in the process puts the rights of most everyone in peril. In what seems a single-minded mission, leaders on the far right have pursued a range of unimagined measures to ensure maximum births. Anyone who performs an abortion in Texas faces a penalty of $100,000 per procedure and up to 20 years in prison. Texans can sue anyone suspected of helping a patient get an abortion. Far-right policymakers have been seeking to target people in free states with potential lawsuits if they help patients from restrictive states who cross state lines for the procedure. A proposal that calls to mind the bounty hunter mechanisms of the Fugitive Slave Acts before the Civil War. No one is spared. Patients in the traumatizing throes of miscarriage, a fate besetting 1 in 10 women in her lifetime, have been turned away in the affected states as hospitals fear running afoul of abortion laws, leaving patients to fend for themselves against potential life-threatening hemorrhage and sepsis. Even groups not inclined to see themselves as marginalized, men of all backgrounds who may not be ready to be fathers, for instance, are getting swept into the undertow of the drive for a higher birth rate that could help stanch the losses in the numbers of the dominant caste. These developments have taught us that in the perhaps unrecognized drive to maintain caste, the rights that many considered established for all time and had perhaps planned their lives around were in fact provisional, hard-fought and short-lived, wholly dependent on who happens to be able to wield power. Caste, the invisible hand beneath our fears and discontents, diminishes us all. It turns neighbor against neighbor, makes spies of ordinary people incited to surveil those targeted by the caste system, forces patients and couples to go underground at a time of personal crisis, crossing borders in secret as people were forced to cross the Iron Curtain or to flee the Jim Crow South. This era is the country's karmic moment of truth. The question now, as it has always been, is what kind of country do we want to be? What are we willing to do to achieve it? Here we are, having to come to terms with the fact that during a global pandemic, the U.S. has led the world in the grimmest of distinctions. Not only has the U.S. exceeded all other countries in the number of recorded COVID-19 deaths, it's led the world in the number of confirmed cases, millions more than the nations with the second highest outbreak, India. The numbers in the U.S. are in line not with our peer nations, but with the developing world. How is it that these two very different countries, the presumed oldest democracy and the largest democracy, have been stricken with these numbers? One country has the world's oldest caste system. The other has a less recognized one. A caste system relies on strife and inequity to sustain itself. It programs people to believe they have no stake in the well-being of those they've been told are beneath them, those they are told are unworthy, undeserving. It makes for a less magnanimous society, a built-in us-versus-them distance between groups. Because of the caste system, we more readily turn against one another. Because of caste, we insufficiently protect one another. Because of caste, along with other breakdowns in society, our democracy is in danger. In that lengthy article, Our Enduring Discontents, How to Understand America, by Isabel Wilkerson, was considerably abridged. Hollywood movies just are not as sexy as they used to be. Blame superheroes. You're only going to hear about a paragraph of this article. It's by Eliana Docterman. Channing Tatum's stripper, Magic Mike, pulls on bookcases and beams in the Miami home of a wealthy woman played by Salma Hayek-Pino. Hayek-Pino's character looks confused, but if you've seen a Magic Mike movie, you know Mike is testing whether the furniture will hold up to his swinging and gyrating. Tatum has a particular talent for swiveling and thrusting in dances steamier than most sex scenes. In Magic Mike's Last Dance, out February 10, Tatum and Hayek-Pino's characters do wind up in bed together, but whether they consummate the relationship is almost academic. He's already wrapped her legs around him and buried his face in her breasts before they ever undress. A rare moment of physical intimacy in a modern film with a big marketing push. Movies are not sexy anymore, or at least the big budget movies that studios dedicate resources to are devoid of lust. Comic book films have come to dominate the box office, and in the words of Steven Soderbergh, director of Last Dance, nobody's F space king in those movies. It is a sentiment he originally shared after being asked why he wasn't interested in helming a superhero movie himself. You can imagine the reaction to those comments, he says now, but it is true. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. The office and studio number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.